Welcome back, everyone. Today we're really diving deep into the life of James Monroe, the fifth U.S. president. You definitely know the name, but his story, well, it often kind of gets overshadowed by Washington, Jefferson, Madison, you know, the really big names. But here's something fascinating. Monroe was quite literally the last of the founding fathers to be president, the last one who'd actually served as an officer in the Continental Army. And almost unbelievably, he died on July 4th, just like Jefferson and Adams. Quite a coincidence, right?
It really is remarkable. He's this unique figure who sort of bridges these distinct generations. You have the, you know, the raw revolutionary spirit of 76, and then you have this expanding, dynamic young nation. Monroe connects those two periods. He wasn't just a leader. He was like a living link back to the origins. His presidency really does feel like the closing of that founding chapter. We've got some great sources for this dive, detailed biographies looking at his personal life, but also some really sharp historical analyses digging into the why behind his big decisions.
Right. And our mission today is basically to give you a shortcut to really understanding Monroe. We want to get beyond just, you know, the list of things he did. We want to look at the pressures he was under, the principles that, well, that guided him and the personal connections. Those were huge for him. We're going to try and peel back the layers, get past the textbook stuff and find the, you know, the human story. Get ready for some, hopefully some real aha moments. His legacy is, I think, a lot richer and more complex than most people realize. Okay, so let's start right at the beginning. Colonial Virginia. Where did he come from? He was born April 28, 1758, Westmoreland County. His father, Andrew Spence Monroe, he was a craftsman, but also a patriot, involved in Stamp Act protests. And his mother, Elizabeth Jones, she came from a slightly wealthier background, daughter of a Welsh immigrant who'd done well. So he wasn't quite from that top-tier planter elite like, say, Jefferson, but definitely not impoverished either.
Right. And his ancestry is pretty interesting, too. You've got Scottish roots, Clan Monroe, and even some French Huguenots mixed in there. He got a solid education early on, Campbelltown Academy, which was considered pretty good for the time. It meant when he got to William & Mary in 74, he could jump straight into advanced Latin and math. He had a good foundation.
But then things took a really tough turn when he was just a teenager. I mean, imagine being 16, suddenly you're the head of the family.
Yeah.
His mother died in 72 after childbirth, and his father passed away not long after that. So as the oldest son, he had to leave college. He had younger brothers to support. That's a huge weight to carry, right? Especially when education was the path forward.
It really was. But that early loss, it turned out to be kind of pivotal in a strange way. It brought him much closer to his uncle on his mother's side, Joseph Jones. Jones was childless, influential, member of the House of Burgesses. He basically became a surrogate father. He helped with debts, but more importantly, he opened doors. He introduced young Monroe to, well, the giants, Jefferson, Patrick Henry, George Washington. These weren't just casual meetings. They were the start of mentorships, connections that really laid the foundation for his entire public life. And you have to remember the atmosphere then in Virginia, it was electric. People were furious about the British intolerable acts. Governor Dunmore in Williamsburg confiscating militia weapons that just poured fuel on the fire. Monroe and his buddies at William & Mary, they weren't just watching. They marched on the governor's palace. They started doing daily military drills. And then June 24, 1775, they actually stormed the palace to grab muskets and swords. This was direct action, defiance, real revolutionary spirit from these students. So when the fighting actually started, Monroe didn't hang back. Early 1776, his brother Spence had died. He left college, joined the 3rd Virginia Regiment. Because he was literate, which was a big plus, he got a commission as a lieutenant. Served under Captain William Washington, a relation of George's. His unit went north. They were part of that really tough retreat across the Delaware River in December 76. A brutal time for the Army.
And this is where it gets really dramatic. You know the painting, Washington crossing the Delaware? Monroe was there, right in the thick of it. He was part of that surprise attack at Trenton, December 26th. And during the fighting, he got hit hard, severed artery, almost bled out. It was a near-fatal wound, but it showed incredible courage. Washington himself praised him, promoted him to captain. I mean, think about it. He's 18 years old, a combat veteran, singled out for bravery by the commander-in-chief. That's extraordinary.
Absolutely formative. And what's really insightful, I think, is how that experience, that brush with death, the sheer brutality of it all, it didn't just make him look brave. It fundamentally shaped his understanding of what war meant, what public service demanded. It forged connections, sure, and an identity he carried his whole life. He was the last president who'd actually fought in the Revolution. But it also gave him this deep pragmatism. He saw the cost firsthand. That definitely influenced how he thought about defense, diplomacy, force later on. After he recovered, took about 2 months, he tried to recruit his own company. That was, you know, the standard path for ambitious officers. But he didn't have the personal wealth, couldn't raise the funds. That was a huge barrier. So instead, he got reassigned to General William Alexander's staff, Lord Stirling, he was known as, a pretty prominent general. And it was during this time he became good friends with Lafayette at the Battle of Brandywine. Then came that infamous winter at Valley Forge. He actually shared a log hut with John Marshall, future Chief Justice. Imagine those conversations. He got promoted to major, but the financial strain, the sheer destitution, eventually forced him to resign his commission in December 78. It really shows the personal toll the war took, even on connected officers. So he goes back to Virginia, hoping for another command, but again, trouble recruiting. His uncle, Joseph Jones, gave him some advice. Go back to Williamsburg, study law under Governor Thomas Jefferson. And this is where that really close, lifelong friendship begins. Jefferson wasn't just a mentor. He gave Monroe access to his amazing library, Epictetus, the Stoics. That stuff really shaped Monroe's thinking about duty. Later in the war, Jefferson appointed him military commissioner. He even became a colonel, but still struggled to actually raise an army. And much to his intense frustration, he ended up missing the Siege of Yorktown, the decisive battle.
Wow. So you have this guy, clearly brave, totally committed, but he keeps getting frustrated trying to raise troops, misses the big finale at Yorktown. It really makes you wonder, doesn't it? How did those repeated setbacks that struggle with the practicalities of fielding an army, how did that shape his views later on, when he actually had power?
That's a great question. And it's clear those experiences left a really deep mark. His frustrations definitely fed into his later understanding of just how complex military organization is and how crucial federal support is for defense. While he always, you know, championed the ideal of the citizen militia, his own struggles probably pushed him towards recognizing the need for more centralized planning, better funding, when he was Secretary of War and President. It turned him into a pragmatist who knew that patriotism alone, well, it wasn't enough to win wars. It's a key thread we see running through his whole career.
Okay, so moving on from the battlefield, Monroe pivots pretty quickly into politics, right? It seems like a very deliberate move. He studies law with Jefferson, and he was apparently pretty candid about it. It wasn't about a love for legal theory. It was for the most immediate rewards. Aren't free. Okay. He saw law as the path to, well, wealth, social standing, and definitely political influence, which is a very calculated mind, I think.
Absolutely. He understood the game. And his rise was pretty fast. Virginia House of Delegates in 82, then again later. But the big step early on was the Continental Congress from 83 to 86. And he wasn't just warming a seat. He was a major voice for Western expansion, involved in drafting the Northwest Ordinance, which was huge. And he fought hard for American navigation rights on the Mississippi, super important economically. So right away, he's working with Jefferson, becoming friends with Madison, but also tackling these enormous territorial issues that would literally shape the map of the U.S. And while all this political activity is ramping up, his personal life is taking shape too. He marries Elizabeth Courtright in February 1786. She was from New York City, high society. That marriage definitely broadened his network beyond Virginia, gave him connections in the North and the financial center. They had three children, Eliza, James, who died young, sadly, and Maria. But it's worth noting, despite these connections, the Monroes often struggled financially throughout his public career. It's a side of public life back then we sometimes forget. Salaries often didn't cover the costs.
Right. Now, here's something that I think genuinely surprises people. James Monroe, founding father, war veteran. He actually voted against the U.S. Constitution. At the Virginia Ratifying Convention in 1788, he was a delegate, and he was part of that group, the Federalists Who Were for Amendments. He wanted changes before signing on, and his objections, they sound really modern in some ways. He was worried about no Bill of Rights, giving the central government too much power to tax, the idea of a standing army. He preferred federal control over militias instead. And he really disliked the Electoral College, thought it was corruptible, wanted direct election of the president. These were big fundamental concerns.
Absolutely. And his stance tells us so much about the deep divisions at the founding. It wasn't all harmony and agreement. His skepticism about a strong central government, a powerful executive that came straight from his Republican principles, his experience fighting what they saw as British tyranny. It was a theme that stayed with him, this caution, even when he held high federal office himself. It wasn't anti-nation, it was anti-centralization of power. In the end, Virginia did ratify, but only just. And it was after Madison basically promised to push for a Bill of Rights, which thankfully he did. And despite being on the losing side of that ratification vote, Monroe's political career kept moving forward. He gets elected to the U.S. Senate in 1790, filling a vacancy. Interestingly, he'd actually run against Madison for a House seat in 89 and lost. In the Senate, he pushed for transparency, wanted sessions open to the public. That took a few years to happen, but he was advocating early. he quickly became a leader of the new Democratic-Republican Party, aligning with Jefferson against Hamilton's Federalist vision. He voted against Hamilton's national bank, saw it as federal overreach. One of only five Southern senators to do so. And this is where things get really intense personally. Monroe gets involved in investigating Alexander Hamilton's finances in 92. Those investigations, which Monroe helped lead, uncovered the whole Hamilton-Reynolds affair. America's first big political sex scandal. Hamilton never forgave Monroe for his role in that public humiliation. It almost came to a duel between them. Mm-hmm. It just shows how raw and personal politics were back then. And on foreign policy, Monroe was consistently pro-French, anti-British. Opposed Hamilton's appointment as ambassador to the UK, supported the French Republic, even wrote essays supporting the French Revolution.
Okay, so given those very strong pro-French feelings, maybe it's not a huge surprise that Washington appoints him minister to France in 1794. Though it sounds like a really tricky assignment, right? The French Revolution is raging. The U.S. is trying to stay neutral between France and Britain. Washington sends Monroe to France and the pro-British John Jay to Britain at the same time. Talk about walking a tightrope.
Exactly. His instructions were clear. Maintain good relations, uphold neutrality. But his personal sympathies were so strongly with France.
He got a really warm welcome in Paris, addressed the National Convention, got a standing ovation for this speech about republicanism. He had some early wins, protected U.S. trade, got some Americans released, including Lafayette's wife, Adrienne. He even sheltered Thomas Paine for a while, though they apparently had a falling out later. But then the Jay Treaty, bam, can you imagine? He's there feeling kinship with the French Republic and suddenly finds out his own country has secretly signed this treaty with Britain, France's mortal enemy. And he wasn't fully in the loop. He was furious.
Absolutely outraged. And it completely torpedoed Franco-American relations. It wasn't just a diplomatic blunder from his perspective. It felt like a betrayal. And it really exposed the deep divisions within Washington's own administration about foreign policy.
Yeah, and that led directly to his recall, didn't it?
It did. What's really instructive here is how Monroe, despite his orders about neutrality, let his strong pro-French feelings kind of, well, color his diplomacy. This led to accusations back home inefficiency, not protecting U.S. interests. Washington recalled him in November 1796, and adding insult to injury, the actual dismissal letter was deliberately held back, apparently to influence the presidential election happening then. It really highlights that tightrope walk of diplomacy, balancing personal beliefs with national interest, especially during a major war. Monroe didn't go quietly, though. He published this defense, A View of the Conduct of the Executive, in 97, basically attacking Washington's administration over the Jay Treaty. Washington famously scribbled angry notes all over his copy, accusing Monroe of being naive, easily flattered by the French.
Yeah.
It was a very bitter end to that first diplomatic mission.
Wow. So after that whole difficult experience abroad, he comes back and jumps right back into Virginia politics.
Yeah.
Governor from 1799 to 1802. And he seems pretty active, pushing for state support for transportation, education, better militia training. He started the whole State of the Commonwealth address tradition, and he established the state's first penitentiary. That was a significant reform, moving away from some of the harsher colonial punishments.
He was definitely an active governor, but his term also saw a major crisis, Gabriel's Rebellion in 1800. This was a large, planned slave uprising near Richmond. Monroe acted swiftly, called out the militia, suppressed it decisively. Gabriel and 27 others were executed.
Yeah, that's a really somber part of his story. His response was firm, but you mentioned there was some nuance, working with the legislature on maybe banishing suspects.
There was some discussion about alternatives to execution, like transportation or banishment, yes. It shows the complexity the balancing act leaders faced regarding slavery. And that event, that direct confrontation with the slave rebellion, plus hearing from Jefferson who urged some mercy, it must have deeply affected Monroe's own thinking on slavery, which, as we know, was complicated and often conflicted. We'll definitely circle back to that. It's also worth remembering, during this time, Monroe was a huge supporter of Jefferson in that really contentious 1800 election. Used his influence in Virginia, even reportedly considered using the state militia to help Jefferson win, shows how high the stakes were.
Okay, so after his governorship, Jefferson calls him back to the national stage pretty quickly for something huge, the Louisiana Purchase.
That's right. 1803, Jefferson sends him to France as a special envoy. Robert Livingston was already there as ambassador. Their mission was critical by New Orleans and, as possible, West Florida from France. Napoleon had secretly gotten Louisiana back from Spain just a few years earlier. Jefferson was absolutely determined to secure control of the Mississippi outlet. He even told Monroe, if the French refuse, you're authorized to talk to the British about an alliance. That's how important it was.
Wow. Alliance with Britain if France wouldn't sell New Orleans. That shows the stakes.
Huge stakes. But what happened next was even more remarkable. Monroe and Livingston, they just went way beyond their instructions. Jefferson had authorized maybe $9 million tops just for New Orleans and West Florida. Instead, they struck a deal for the entire Louisiana territory. $15 million. They basically doubled the size of the United States in one go.
Just like that. Talk about audacity. They must have known they were exceeding their authority, right?
Oh, absolutely. It was a massive gamble. A breathtaking example of seizing a strategic moment, even if it meant risking serious trouble back home. But what an opportunity.
So, looking at the big picture, the Louisiana Purchase wasn't just land. It was, I mean, it defined westward expansion for generations, completely changed the country's future. And Monroe, even though he technically disobeyed orders, played this absolutely crucial role.
Crucial, yes. And Jefferson, despite his own initial constitutional worries about whether the federal government even could buy that much land, he saw the immense value. He backed Monroe and Livingston fully, got Congress to approve it quickly. Monroe's follow-up mission to Spain in 1805 to try and get West Florida, though, that didn't go so well. The Spanish were annoyed, the American ambassador there was apparently quite aggressive, and they made no progress. So that peace remained unresolved for a while.
Okay, so after the Louisiana triumph, his next big posting is Minister to Great Britain, 1803 to 1807. And the big issue there was impressment, right?
Exactly. That was the constant major point of friction. The British Navy desperately needed sailors for the Napoleonic Wars, so they'd stop American ships and just take sailors off them. Now, sure, some were probably British deserters hiding on U.S. ships, but they also grabbed plenty of legitimate American citizens. It caused absolute outrage in the States.
And Monroe didn't have much luck stopping it.
Very little success, unfortunately. Part of the problem was that Jefferson had kind of alienated the British minister in Washington, Anthony Mary. So the diplomatic climate wasn't great to begin with. It was just this period of ongoing tension, unresolved grievances over impressment that really poisoned relations and pushed things closer to conflict later on.
Which leads us to the Monroe-Pinckney Treaty in 1806. What was that about?
Right. Monroe, working with William Pinckney, managed to negotiate this treaty with Britain. It was basically an attempt to renew the old Jay Treaty, keep trade flowing for another 10 years, try to stabilize things. But Jefferson made the really controversial call not to even send it to the Senate for ratification.
Why not? After all that work.
Because it didn't explicitly end impressment. That was Jefferson's absolute red line. Plus, he had always disliked the original Jay Treaty anyway. By this point, Jefferson was really leaning towards using economic pressure, commercial warfare, against Britain. A treaty that just continued trade without solving impressment didn't fit that strategy at all.
So rejecting the treaty, what were the long-term consequences of that decision?
Well, it's a big what if, isn't it? Many historians argue that rejecting a treaty that offered peace offered economic stability, mostly because of impressment. Well, it pretty much guaranteed the drift towards the War of 1812. It closed off a potential path to de-escalation. A really significant missed opportunity, you could argue.
And how did Monroe take this? He negotiated it, after all.
He was, reportedly, severely pained. Felt his hard work was completely repudiated. And it caused a major rift, a real falling out, with James Madison, who was Secretary of State and had backed Jefferson's decision. That friendship took a big hit. The political fallout spilled right into the 1808 election. People urged Monroe to run against Madison. Monroe apparently felt Jefferson had snubbed the treaty partly to help Madison succeed him. He did run against Madison, showed he still had support in Virginia, but lost pretty badly overall. Only got about 3,400 votes in Virginia. A clear defeat.
Man, that's a rough patch. You go from the high of the Louisiana Purchase to getting your treaty shot down, losing a presidential bid to your former friend, it really shows how brutal politics could be.
Absolutely. So he withdrew for a bit, went back to his farm in Charlottesville, focused on agriculture, tried growing wheat instead of tobacco. Thankfully, for the country's sake, he did eventually patch things up with Jefferson and, importantly, with Madison by around 1810, which was crucial because his return to service was just around the corner, right as war clouds were gathering again.
Right. So after a very brief second stint as governor of Virginia in 1811, like, only 4 months, Madison calls him back.
Yep. Madison appoints him Secretary of State in April 1811. Madison needed to shore up support, especially with the more radical wing of his party, and the previous secretary, Robert Smith, hadn't been great. Madison apparently told Monroe their past disagreements were just a misunderstanding. So the friendship was back on track, and they started working together again.
And the Senate confirmed him unanimously, 30-0. That says a lot about his standing.
It really does. Shows broad respect, perceived competence. He was seen as a steady hand, which was needed. As Secretary of State, his first job was, again, trying to deal with Britain and France attacking American ships. He hoped he could negotiate treaties to stop the attack, stop impressment. The French were a bit more receptive, agreed to ease up. The British, though, especially on impressment, they weren't budging.
So diplomacy wasn't working with Britain?
Pretty much. And this is where you see Monroe's thinking evolve again. He'd always worked for peace, for diplomatic solutions. But now, facing British refusal to compromise, he started to favor war. He joined the war hawks in Congress, people like Henry Clay. He came to believe diplomacy had failed, and war was the only option left to defend American rights and honor. So he supported Madison when he asked Congress to declare war in June 1812.
And the War of 1812, it didn't start well for the U.S., did it?
No, it went badly at first. The administration tried to sue for peace pretty quickly, but the British weren't interested then. Monroe, as Secretary of State, did manage to persuade Madison to let the Navy ships actually go out and fight rather than stay in port. That led to a few important morale-boosting victories at sea. But the Army leadership was struggling. The Secretary of War, William Eustis, resigned. Madison asked Monroe to step in, do both jobs, state and war. The Senate balked at that initially, so he could only be acting Secretary of War for a while. And he clashed quite a bit with the man who eventually got the job officially, John Armstrong Jr., over how to run the war.
And then came that really dramatic moment in 1814 with the British threatening Washington, D.C. Monroe really stepped up there, didn't he?
He absolutely did. As British ships started probing the Chesapeake Bay, Monroe was sounding the alarm bells loud and clear. He was urging defensive preparations for the capital, wanted better military intelligence. But Armstrong, the Secretary of War, basically dismissed his concerns, thought he was being alarmist.
Unbelievable. So what did Monroe do?
He took matters into his own hands. He literally formed his own small cavalry troop and rode down himself to scout the British movements in the bay. Can you imagine a Secretary of State doing that today?
No way. That's incredible initiative, especially when the guy officially in charge was ignoring the threat.
It really highlights his commitment, his willingness to act decisively, even outside his official lane when he saw a threat. That experience must have profoundly shaped his views on executive responsibility and military readiness later on.
And tragically, his warnings were right.
Yeah.
The British did invade.
They did. A large force landed. Monroe scouted them again, sent an urgent message to Madison on August 21st, warning of the imminent attack. That warning gave Madison and Dolly just enough time to flee the Capitol. And then, August 24th, the British marched in and burned the Capitol building and the White House. A devastating blow to national morale.
Just awful. And that finally got Armstrong fired.
Yes. After that disaster, Madison removed Armstrong and formally appointed Monroe as Secretary of War on September 27th. Monroe resigned as Secretary of State on October 1st. But crucially, Madison didn't appoint a successor right away. So for several critical months, from October 1814 to late February 1815, Monroe was effectively running both the State Department and the War Department during wartime. Incredible responsibility.
And he seems to have grabbed the reins pretty firmly.
He did. He immediately ordered Andrew Jackson down to defend New Orleans, anticipating a British attack there, which turned out to be spot on. He went to Congress, asked for bold measures, draft 100,000 men, increase pay for soldiers, and crucially, establish the Second Bank of the United States to fund the war effort properly. His leadership really seemed to energize the war effort in those final months. Then the Treaty of Ghent was signed, ending the war, basically returning things to how they were before. News of the treaty arrived just after Jackson's huge victory at New Orleans. Even though the battle technically happened after the peace treaty, that victory was a massive boost for American confidence. And with Napoleon defeated in Europe, the British stopped impressment anyway. Congress also approved the Second Bank.
So Monroe comes out of this war looking pretty good.
Very strong. He'd proven himself as a capable wartime leader under extreme pressure. Resigned as Secretary of War in March 1815, went back to being Secretary of State. But yeah, he was clearly positioned as a leading presidential contender.
Okay, so his wartime leadership definitely set him up as Madison's successor. Heading into the 1816 election, it seemed like his nomination was pretty likely.
It was. The Federalist Party was basically falling apart by then, especially after their opposition to the War of 1812, which made them look almost disloyal to many. So the real contest was within the Democratic-Republican Party's Congressional Caucus, which chose the nominee back then.
No.
He faced some challenge from William H. Crawford of Georgia and Daniel D. Tompkins of New York, but Crawford eventually stepped aside. Monroe got the presidential nomination, Tompkins for VP.
And the election itself was a landslide.
Oh, completely. Right. He crushed the Federalist candidate, Rufus King, got 183 electoral votes out of 217, won every state except Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Delaware.
Imagine that today, being elected with virtually no real opposition. So his inauguration in 1817 kicks off this period we call the era of good feelings. What did that actually mean? Was it really all good feelings?
Well, good feelings might be stretching it a bit. It wasn't that political disagreements vanished entirely, but the term reflected a real national mood, a desire for unity after the war. The collapse of the Federalists meant less partisan fighting, at least on the surface. And Monroe himself really leaned into this idea of national unity. He consciously tried to downplay old party loyalties in his appointments. He went on these two long national tours, traveling all over the country, which was unusual then, trying to build goodwill and foster a sense of shared American identity. And symbolically, he really was this bridge figure. The last president, who was also a founding father, served in the Revolution, delegate to the Continental Congress, also the last of that so-called Virginia dynasty. His presidency definitely felt like a transition.
And his cabinet choices reflected that unity goal.
Very much so. He deliberately built a cabinet that was geographically balanced, bringing in people from different regions. He kept Crawford from Georgia at Treasury. But crucially, he appointed John Quincy Adams from Massachusetts as Secretary of State. This was a big deal. Adams wasn't a Virginian, and Secretary of State was seen as the stepping stone to the presidency. It immediately made Adams the likely successor, which helped ease Northern concerns about Virginia's dominance. He also brought in John C. Calhoun from South Carolina as Secretary of War. So you had key figures from the South, New England, Georgia, a truly national team. One historian, William Earl Weeks, described Monroe's overall strategy perfectly, I think. Expanding the Union externally while solidifying it internally. That really captures his approach. Managing expansion, dealing with slavery somehow, keeping the country together.
Expand outwards, strengthen inwards. It sounds good, but how did that actually work? Especially with slavery becoming more and more divisive. How did he manage to hold things together during this supposed era of good feelings?
It was an incredible balancing act. Part of it was his persona. He projected this image of calm, steady leadership above the fray. The national tours helped that. Part of it was shrewd politics, like the cabinet appointments. And part of it was, frankly, kicking the can down the road on the toughest issues, like slavery, finding compromises that delayed the inevitable confrontation. He was very skilled at building consensus, or at least the appearance of it, even if the foundations were sometimes shaky. That ability to navigate those deep divisions was probably his greatest domestic achievement, keeping the Union intact during a potentially explosive period.
Okay, let's talk foreign policy during his presidency. It seems like a really successful area for him. He managed to settle some long-standing issues, didn't he?
Absolutely. Big achievements, first off, with Britain. Remember all the tension leading up to 1812? Well, after the war, things calmed down considerably. In 1817, they signed the Rushbaggett Treaty. This basically demilitarized the Great Lakes and Lake Champlain, a huge step in normalizing the border with British Canada. Then, the Treaty of 1818, also with Britain. This formally set the border at the 49th parallel, all the way from Minnesota out to the Rocky Mountains, and it agreed on joint U.S.-British occupation of the Oregon country for 10 years.
So after literally decades of conflict and near conflict, these treaties brought real stability to that northern border. That's huge. We kind of take that peaceful border for granted now.
Exactly. Laid the groundwork for a peaceful relationship moving forward. And it wasn't just Britain. There were issues brewing with Russia up in the Pacific Northwest. Russia was expanding its claims down the coast. The Russo-American Treaty of 1824 settled that, setting the southern limit of Russian claims at the 54-degree 40-Ori parallel, resolved another potential flashpoint.
Okay. And then there's the acquisition of Florida. How did that come about? Spain wasn't just giving it away, were they?
Not exactly giving it away, but Spain was definitely in a weak position. They were exhausted from the Napoleonic Wars in Europe. Their American colonies were revolting all over the place. Florida was becoming more trouble than it was worth for them.
Yeah.
You had American settlers pushing in, runaway slaves finding refuge there, Seminole Indians raiding across the border into Georgia. Spain couldn't really control it.
So the U.S. saw an opportunity.
Pretty much. There were ongoing Seminole raids, and they were known to be harboring escaped slaves. Monroe ordered a military expedition into Spanish Florida under Andrew Jackson. Now Jackson being Jackson. He went way beyond his official orders. He chased the Seminoles, burned their towns, and then he seized Pensacola, the Spanish capital there, basically took de facto control of Florida.
That sounds controversial. Didn't that cause problems? An American general invading Spanish territory?
Oh, big time. Congress was highly critical, debated whether Jackson had started an undeclared war. It was a real diplomatic headache. But here's where Monroe and his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, were very shrewd. Monroe publicly backed Jackson, defended his actions as necessary, but Adams, behind the scenes, carefully spun the situation. He basically told Spain, look, you can't control Florida. It's causing problems for us. Jackson's actions were defensive. He removed the parts of Jackson's justification that were most aggressive. This diplomatic maneuvering put Spain in a position where ceding Florida seemed like the best option.
Clever. So Jackson's aggression created the opening, and Adams skillfully exploited it.
Exactly. It led directly to the Adams-Onis Treaty of 1819. Spain formally ceded Florida to the U.S. In return, the U.S. agreed to assume about $5 million in claims that American citizens had against Spain. And crucially, the treaty also drew a clear boundary line between U.S. territory and Spanish possessions, running all the way from the Sabine River, border of Louisiana and Texas, out to the Pacific Ocean. The U.S. gave up claims to Texas for the time being, but Spain gave up its claims to the Oregon country, a massive territorial gain and clarification of boundaries.
Wow. So Florida secured, borders defined. That's huge. And this is all happening while Latin America is fighting for independence from Spain, right? How did Monroe handle that?
That's another key part of his foreign policy legacy. He was personally very sympathetic to the independence movements in South America. He saw them as fellow republics throwing off European monarchy. But initially, while the delicate Florida negotiations with Spain were ongoing, he maintained official neutrality, didn't want to jeopardize getting Florida. However, as soon as the Adams-Onis Treaty was ratified in 1821, the U.S. moved decisively. They became the first nation in the world to officially recognize the new independent republics, Argentina, Peru, Colombia, Chile, Mexico. Monroe took great pride in this. He felt the U.S. was setting an example, supporting liberty in the hemisphere. It marked a real shift towards seeing the Americas as a distinct sphere.
Okay, so this leads us directly into the most famous part of his foreign policy, the Monroe Doctrine. Where did that come from? Was it entirely his idea?
Not entirely his alone. It evolved. John Quincy Adams, the Secretary of State, had actually floated the core idea earlier, back in 1821. The idea that the American continent should be considered closed to future colonization by European powers. This thinking was shaped by the Adams-Onis Treaty defining borders and the ongoing disputes about Oregon, especially with Russia. The immediate trigger, though, was the fear that European powers, particularly France and the conservative Holy Alliance of Russia, Prussia, and Austria, might try to intervene in Latin America to help Spain restore its colonies. That was a real concern.
So how did the U.S. respond to that threat?
Well, interestingly, the British actually proposed a joint Anglo-American declaration. The British Foreign Secretary, George Canning, suggested they issue a statement together, warning against European intervention in the Americas. Monroe himself was initially inclined to accept the British offer. It seemed like a safe way to achieve the goal with British naval power backing it up.
But Adams disagreed.
Adams argued very forcefully against it. He basically said, "Why should we come in as a cockboat in the wake of the British man of war?" He argued that a joint declaration would limit future U.S. options, maybe prevent future U.S. expansion, like into Cuba, which some Americans coveted. And he suspected Britain had its own imperial interests, not just a love for Latin American independence. He urged Monroe to make a purely American statement.
And Monroe listened to Adams?
He did. Persuaded by Adams's logic and genuinely concerned about potential European recolonization efforts, Monroe decided to act unilaterally. In his annual message to Congress on December 2, 1823, he laid out the principles that became known as the Monroe Doctrine.
What were the key points?
There were basically three main tenets. First, the U.S. would stick to its traditional policy of neutrality in purely European wars. Second, the U.S. would not accept the recolonization of any independent nation in the Americas by its former European ruler, though it wouldn't interfere with existing colonies. And third, and most famously, the Western Hemisphere was henceforth closed to new European colonization. This was aimed partly at Russia's ambitions on the Pacific coast.
So this was a really bold statement, wasn't it? The U.S. basically declaring the entire Western Hemisphere off limits to further European meddling.
Incredibly bold for a relatively young nation. It was a unilateral declaration principle, rejecting British partnership, asserting American leadership in the hemisphere.
And its impact. How significant was the Monroe Doctrine long term?
Immense. It became a cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy for over a century. It defined America's sphere of influence, signaled a decisive turn away from European entanglements towards a focus on the Americas. It fundamentally shaped how the U.S. saw its role in the world, a truly defining moment.
Okay, so foreign policy looks like a big success story. But domestically, that era of good feelings label starts to look pretty shaky when you dig into things like slavery, right?
Absolutely. The facade of unity cracked badly over slavery. The country was expanding rapidly. Mississippi, Illinois, Alabama all became states between 1817 and 1819. This rapid westward growth highlighted the growing economic differences between North and South and shifted the balance of power in Congress, which terrified the Southern slave states.
And then Missouri applied for statehood in 1819. That really blew things up.
It ignited a firestorm. A New York congressman, James Talmadge Jr., proposed an amendment to Missouri's statehood bill. The Talmadge Amendment had two parts: prohibit any more slaves from being brought into Missouri, and free the children born to slaves already there once they reached age 25. It passed the House, where the North had more population and thus more votes, but it was soundly rejected by the Senate, where the South had equal representation.
So we instantly polarized everyone.
Completely. You had the Northern restrictionists who wanted to stop slavery spread versus the Southern anti-restrictionists who insisted Congress had no right to interfere with slavery in the territories or new states. The debate was incredibly bitter. It really exposed that deep, dangerous fault line running through the nation.
And the solution was the Missouri Compromise of 1820. What did that entail?
It was a classic political compromise brokered largely by Henry Clay. Three main parts. First, Maine, which had been part of Massachusetts, was admitted as a free state. Second, Missouri was admitted as a slave state, maintaining the balance between free and slave states in the Senate. Third, and perhaps most significantly for the future, slavery was prohibited in the rest of the Louisiana Purchase Territory north of the 36-degree 38 first parallel. That line was Missouri's southern border.
So it settled the immediate crisis, but it didn't really solve the underlying problem, did it?
Not at all. It was a temporary fix, a Band-Aid. Monroe himself signed it, apparently reluctantly. He saw it as the least bad option to preserve the Union and protect slaveholders' interests for the time being. But the whole crisis showed that even with the Federalist Party gone, the most dangerous divisions weren't between parties, but between sections, rooted fundamentally in slavery. The compromise just kicked the can down the road, allowing expansion to continue for a few more decades, but the fundamental conflict remained.
Okay, what about other domestic issues? Infrastructure, the economy.
Monroe definitely saw the need for better infrastructure, roads, canals. He believed a good transportation network was vital for economic growth, national unity, even defense. But he had serious constitutional doubts about the federal government's role in actually building and running these things.
Strict constructionist views again.
Exactly. He didn't think the Constitution gave Congress the power to create a national transportation system. He kept urging Congress to pass a constitutional amendment to grant that power explicitly. Congress never did. So, in 1822, he stuck to his principles and vetoed a bill for collecting tolls to repair the Cumberland Road, a major federal project. He argued the repairs were okay, but federal operation via tolls was unconstitutional.
That seems like a fine distinction, but it shows his commitment to that strict interpretation.
It does. It sparked a lot of debate about the federal role in internal improvements, a debate that continued for years. However, things did start to shift later in his presidency. The Supreme Court ruling in Gibbons v. Ogden in 1824 gave the federal government much broader authority over interstate commerce. After that, Congress felt more empowered. They passed the General Survey Act, authorizing planning for national roads and canals, and started appropriating money for things like river navigation improvements, often using the Army Corps of Engineers. So federal involvement began to grow, despite Monroe's earlier reservations.
And the economy wasn't all smooth sailing either, right? The Panic of 1819.
No, definitely not. That panic was the first major economic depression the country faced under the Constitution. It really shook things up. It had complex causes, global markets readjusting after the Napoleonic Wars ended, leading to falling demand for American exports, falling agricultural prices. But it was made much worse by domestic factors. Rampant speculation in Western lands, and way too much paper money being issued by poorly regulated state banks.
Yeah.
A classic boom and bust cycle.
And could Monroe do much about it?
Very little, actually. The federal government just didn't have the tools or the accepted authority to intervene directly in the economy back then. Banks were mostly state chartered and state regulated. So the crisis led to widespread unemployment, bankruptcies, foreclosures. Lots of popular anger directed at banks and speculators. Monroe's administration ended up cutting the federal budget pretty drastically in response, including defense spending. He asked Congress for higher tariffs to protect American industries in 1819, but they didn't actually pass a significant tariff increase until 1824. So yeah, the panic really exposed the economy's vulnerabilities and the limits of federal power at the time.
And finally, Native American policy during this era. How did Monroe approach that?
It's a difficult and frankly tragic part of the story, intertwined with westward expansion. He put his Secretary of War, Calhoun, in charge of managing relations with tribes in the West. Monroe himself advocated a policy that, on the surface, sounded somewhat progressive for the time. He talked about dividing up territories, assigning specific lands to different tribes, even setting up civil governments and schools within those lands. But he also, quite explicitly, in an 1824 speech to Congress, advocated for the resettlement of Native Americans living east of the Mississippi to lands west of the frontier.
So removal, basically, even if it was framed differently.
Essentially, yes. He shared the view, common among leaders like Jackson and Calhoun, that sovereign Indian nations within U.S. borders were obstacles to national development and expansion. He genuinely seemed to believe he was acting in their best interest, presenting the benefits of American culture to save them from what he saw as inevitable extinction if they stayed put. Paternalistic, certainly. But the practical effect of this policy, this push for resettlement, was to pave the way for the forced removals and assimilation policies that came later under Jackson and subsequent presidents. It's a stark reminder that even during the era of good feelings, the drive for expansion often came at a terrible human cost for Native Americans.
So after two terms, Monroe leaves the presidency in 1825. What was his retirement like? Did he enjoy a peaceful elder statesman role?
Well, he certainly tried to pursue intellectual interests. He retired to his estates, Monroe Hill near UVA and Oak Hill. He read extensively, apparently had a library of over 3,000 books, many picked up during his time in Europe. He even started writing a couple books, one on political theory, The People, the Sovereigns, and then an autobiography. Neither was finished, unfortunately.
But you mentioned earlier he had money problems. Did those continue into retirement?
Oh, severely. It's actually quite shocking. Here's a man who served in top posts for decades. Mm-hmm. Senator, governor, diplomat, cabinet secretary, president. And he was plagued by financial worries his whole life, right up to the end.
How could that happen?
Government salaries back then were modest, especially for diplomats abroad. He'd taken out large personal loans while minister to France just to cover expenses. He spent years trying, unsuccessfully, to get Congress to reimburse him for expenses dating back to the 1790s. He eventually had to sell his Highland plantation just to pay off debts. His wife's poor health also added significant expenses. It's a really stark contrast to how former presidents live today. It underscores the personal sacrifices involved in public service then.
Incredible. But he didn't completely withdraw from public life, did he?
No, not at all. He remained very involved with the University of Virginia, serving on its board of visitors alongside Jefferson and Madison. He even argued for including military drill in the curriculum, though Madison apparently overruled him on that. And even though he was getting older and had been injured in a horse riding accident, he was elected as a delegate to the Virginia Constitutional Convention in 1829-1830. They even elected him presiding officer, which shows the immense respect he still commanded. But his health was failing, and he had to withdraw before it concluded. Still, that commitment to public service, almost literally to the end, is quite remarkable.
Let's circle back to his views on slavery, especially in these later years. You said it was complex. How did he reconcile owning slaves with his stated dislike for the institution?
It's the great contradiction, isn't it? He owned dozens of slaves throughout his life. His plantations weren't profitable, and he sometimes had to sell enslaved people to cover his debts, which is just awful to contemplate. Yet, by all accounts, he genuinely disliked slavery personally. He supported the idea of private manumission, freeing slaves individually. He read and apparently respected abolitionist writers like William Wilberforce. He publicly called slavery a blight.
But he never freed his own slaves during his lifetime, did he? And he defended the institution's permanence in the South.
That's the agonizing conflict. He seemed to believe that immediate, large-scale emancipation would cause chaos race war like in Haiti, class war like in France. He feared it would destroy the social order of the South. So, while he might have wished it away, he saw it as too entrenched, too dangerous to dismantle quickly. At that 1829 Virginia Convention, he repeated his view that Virginia had tried to end the slave trade as a colony, but was overruled by Britain. And he proposed a plan there for gradual emancipation funded by the federal government, but crucially, coupled with deporting the freed slaves to colonies outside the U.S. like Liberia.
So his solution was emancipation plus removal?
Exactly. He couldn't envision, or perhaps couldn't accept, a biracial society with free African Americans living alongside whites. It reflects the deep-seated racism of the era, even among those who found slavery morally troubling. He was very active in the American Colonization Society, which promoted establishing colonies in Africa for free blacks. Liberia's capital, Monrovia, is named after him for that reason. It was seen by many white leaders then as the only viable solution.
It's a really difficult legacy to grapple with. A man caught between revolutionary ideals and the entrenched reality of slavery.
Absolutely. He embodies that profound dilemma faced by many in the founding generation.
His final years were marked by more personal loss, weren't they?
Very sad ending.
Yeah.
His son-in-law died, and then his wife, Elizabeth, passed away just 2 days later in 1830. A double blow. After that, he moved to New York City to live with his daughter, Maria. And it was there that he died, on July 4th, 1831, age 73. Heart failure and tuberculosis were cited.
The third president to die on Independence Day. Just incredible.
Truly remarkable coincidence. He was initially buried in New York, but later his remains were moved back to Richmond, Virginia, to Hollywood Cemetery, where his tomb is now a landmark.
So how do historians generally view his presidency now? What's the consensus on his legacy?
Generally, he's ranked as an above-average president. Not usually in the top tier with Washington or Lincoln, but consistently seen as effective and significant. He presided over that key moment when the U.S. really turned from focusing on European conflicts towards its own hemisphere and internal development. He settled major boundary disputes, acquired Florida, navigated the Missouri crisis, asserted American influence with the Monroe Doctrine. Some historians, like Fred Greenstein, argue he was actually a more effective executive, a better manager, than perhaps even Madison or John Adams, despite their greater intellectual reputations. He was a pragmatist, a unifier, a bridge figure.
The last cocked hat, they called him, because he's the last president to wear the old-style knee breeches and powdered wig. But his legacy is clearly much more than just fashion.
Definitely. He left a huge mark on the nation's geography and its place in the world. His contributions from the battlefield at Trenton to the diplomacy behind the Monroe Doctrine were substantial, which does make you wonder, considering everything he accomplished, navigating expansion, foreign threats, internal crises, does above average really capture the full impact of his presidency? He solidified so much for the young nation.
Yeah, it's a good point. From that young soldier bleeding at Trenton to the architect of the Monroe Doctrine, James Monroe's journey really does mirror the evolution of the American experiment itself, doesn't it? He guided the nation through some really choppy waters, internationally and domestically, leaving a pretty significant mark. A pragmatist, definitely.
He really was that bridge figure, you know, steeped in the ideals of the revolution, but having to deal with the messy realities of a growing, changing, and deeply divided nation. His knack for pulling together different strands, managing complex issues, allowed him to craft policies that shaped the U.S. for decades. Defining its role on the continent while wrestling with those fundamental contradictions at its core.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into James Monroe, thinking about his presidency, that balancing act he performed between pushing for national unity while also driving expansion, dealing with those deep internal splits, kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it? How much of that struggle, those compromises, still echoes in the challenges we face today? And maybe, just maybe, are there lessons we can pull from that era of good feelings, an era of both ambition and deep contradiction for our own very polarized times? Something to think about.